You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Right on cue, he joins us. The man, the myth, the legend himself, Michael Musselman. What's going on, Gunner? How are you doing? Hello? What happened? Everything worked, but I don't hear you. Can you hear me? Yikes. Earth to Musselman, over.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
Oh, I thought he answered the phone. Evidently not. The, well, that'll teach me. What happened to the Rawhide song? You know, I'm not a big fan of this doing this kind of stuff, but it comes with breaking news and all that kind of stuff. It's part of our culture now. But breaking news. There's been a shooting in Maryland. Three dead after a woman opens fire at a Rite Aid store. At least three people were killed after a woman opened fire at a Rite Aid facility in Maryland this morning, according to law enforcement officials. The incident in Aberdeen, Maryland, about 30 miles from Baltimore, home of the Aberdeen Proving Grounds, I might add, appears to be over and the suspect has been detained, multiple law enforcement officials said. Harford County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to the scene at 9:09 a.m. Eastern Time, the Sheriff's Office tweeted, adding there were multiple victims. In a separate tweet, the Sheriff's Office advised people to avoid the area. The shooting occurred at a Rite Aid distribution center, where products are received from manufacturers and sent to the store, according to Susan Henderson, a spokesman for the drugstore chain. So here's a news report from NBC. I can make it play.
Say several people have been shot in the city of Aberdeen, Maryland. This is about 35 miles northeast of Baltimore, about 50 miles southwest of Wilmington, Delaware. NBC Justice correspondent Pete Williams is live in Washington. He's been getting details on this. Pete, what can you tell us?
Well, right now we can change this banner at the bottom of the screen that says the suspect is still at large. I'm told by several law enforcement officials that that's no longer the case, that the suspect is down, that this shooting situation is over. I'm told that the suspect is a woman, which makes this an unusual workplace shooting. This is at a Rite Aid warehouse in Aberdeen, Maryland, which is north of Baltimore. The first reports came in about 9 o'clock this morning. The officials had said multiple people were shot. We now believe that the number shot may be around 5. Perhaps 4 of them appear, the injuries appear to be fatal. So this would be perhaps 4 people shot. But in any event, it does appear to be over now. There was a long period of time of searching through that warehouse to try to find the suspect who was responsible for this shooting, and that appears to be over. Very tense moments this morning. Some people inside the building sending tweets to their loved ones saying that there was an active shooter, that they were hiding, didn't know if they would make it out. But now we know that this is over. We don't know the total number of employees who worked in this warehouse. We think it's around 100 or so.
Wow.
This Rite Aid drug distribution, prescription drug supply distribution warehouse for the Rite Aid drug stores in that region. About 2 hours after it started, it appears now to be over. The suspect has been identified, apprehended, is down, is what we're told by law enforcement officials. And we should be hearing more from the county sheriff, the Harford County, Maryland sheriff, in about half an hour.
They haven't. I think we should.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
What is going on? We continue to do the kabuki dance. I had this all wired too, by the way. I did some work to switch this stuff up so none of it would
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
Hey, doofus. Nice work. What could possibly... Okay, so think. Why would this be going wrong? Would he be calling me from his phone? Missed call. See, but Mike's an Apple guy.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after...
No, he called me. So, but he's not picking up. And he's an Apple guy, so the thought went through my head, I'm calling his computer, blah, 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 blah. So, we may have to roll old school and just do it cell phone style. Not really sure what's going on. We'll get to the bottom of this, though. What's going on? What's happening?
Get back on Skype.
What's that?
I'm trying to get you back on Skype.
I know. I was calling, but you weren't picking up, and then you called me on my cell, and...
Yeah. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Hello?
All right.
Are we good?
Has gotten a vote today.
What has gotten a vote today?
Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
Murphy is alive and well in Grimberg, Texas today.
Why, did you do anything? Were you doing anything high speed? See, I reconfigured some stuff so it would work like glass. But
The the lawn guys just left, so I was kind of like trying to get done with them, and they just walked out. I came in here. I tried to call. I couldn't get the mouse to work. I'm like, okay. So the mouse wasn't working. So finally I got the mouse to work, and then you were calling. I couldn't click because the mouse battery died. So then I ran back in there trying to find two AA batteries for the Apple mouse. You know, and it's like one thing after another, and yeah, crazy, man.
Oh my God. The
But the water problem is fixed. So
you have it. I still haven't fixed mine. I fixed one. I have two issues. One of them I fixed. The other one I have to dig some more of the pipe up to find where the leak is. The leak is not where I thought it would be, which would be where the riser is. That's where water's collecting, but there must be, the leak is someplace else. So I've got to go, I've got to do a little bit more excavation.
Nice.
Do you like that kind of stuff? I like that kind of stuff. I like manual labor, problems in front of me, right?
Yeah, I know I do. I just don't like it when it's not going, you're trying to fix it and it's not wanting to be fixed.
Not cooperating. It's a
complex thing. That's what starts pissing me off.
But
I get a little bit PO'd, man.
But again, it's for me, it's like cleaning. It's in front of me. I can do it. I don't need anybody else. I'm going to see the fruits of my work. It's all going to be self-contained. I like this. I like this. Just on my own, living my life, making my life, my world a little bit better. So I actually like a little bit of complication in it. Like it's a little bit more difficult problem than I thought it was. I don't mind that. I like a little complexity. I don't like when I hit something and it's like it reroutes the problem. Oh no, you thought it was this. It's not. It's something much deeper. So I like that. I don't know that I'd like to do those things every day, but I like the variety in my life. What? Any idea what caused your water leak?
Mm-mm. He pulled it out and replaced it. I didn't really ask at that point. I'm just glad to get it done.
All right. All right. What else has been going on in your life? Anything exciting?
No. I'm trying to think. No on that category. No.
No, nothing. Come on, you live it normally. You live in it.
Hey, have you seen the movie Hell in High Water? Or what was it called?
No.
Hell in High Water.
No, I'm not. I have not.
Maybe
I have. Is it a World War II?
No, it's a bank robbery.
Oh no.
Hell or High Water? Yeah, it's bank robbery. Oh. Down here in Texas, it's funny as shit, man.
Who's in it?
Jeff Bridges. Chris Pine, you know who he is, right?
No.
Chris Pine, the guy who plays Star Trek, Captain Kirk, the new one.
Oh, the new Captain Kirk? Kind of a weird looking dude.
Yeah, the new guy.
Yeah. Okay, I know who that guy is.
Ben Foster. You've seen Ben Foster a lot. He always plays like the guy that you would want in he's a tough guy. He played the bad guy in 310 to Yuma. Remember that Western with,
no.
Russell Crowe?
No.
Oh, man, you're missing out.
I know. I don't go see a lot of movies.
Ben Foster's a good actor. He's a really good actor. He played in like all the Boston gangster movies, like the recent ones with Ben Affleck, you know, when they go rob the stadium and shit like that. I mean, he plays a bad guy like that.
Didn't watch that. I've seen Ocean's 11. I saw that once with Colleen.
No, so
I've seen The Life of Pi.
Chris Pine and him are brothers, and they decide, you know what? Let's go rob better banks to pay off the mortgage from their land. Which, hey, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges plays an old, crusty getting ready to retire Texas Ranger that's hunting him down with his buddy. And he always makes fun of him about being an Indian, you know, like just smart ass remarks about, you know, Indian stuff. But it's a really good, it's a funny movie, but yet kind of serious. The brother, Chris Pine, is kind of a nice guy. He doesn't want to tip the boat. Ben Foster, the brother, is like a maverick, man. He's easy set up. Like, flashbang is, you know, nanosecond.
All right.
But it's a good, good, good movie. And it's funny. Because Jeff Bridges usually plays kind of, sometimes he plays some really goofy ones, like Men in Black. You know, remember he played the, not Men in Black. Was it Men in Black? No, he played some other.
I thought Men in Black was Tommy Lee Jones and Will.
He played it with like a space cop. They had to shoot ghosts. You know, he's like a cowboy guy, and then the guy who plays the hell is Deadpool. But yeah, Big Lebowski is his big one. You know, that's what Jeff Bridges is known for.
We had guys who could literally recite that movie in Afghanistan. Chris Julian was one of them. I think F-18 Man can recite most of that movie as well. The Big Lebowski. It's a little bit of a.
It's got some really good quotes.
Cult event. It's really funny though. If you lived in California at any time in your life near the coast, you run into these dudes. Literally, they're just they kind of high school guys. They're surfers. They're not too serious about life, hanging out in places like the Beachcomber, different places in PB, and they just...
My favorite guy is Sam Elliott, the stranger. That's his role, the stranger.
He's got a great voice for it, great look. He does it.
Oh, Sam Elliott is like the true, you know, cowboy, you know, look.
Yep. But I don't know who wrote that movie, but there's some awesome stuff in there that you know, he's John Goodman's, you know, waxing eloquent about Vietnam and face down in the mud, and the dude looks at him and says, "Dude, you weren't even in Vietnam."
Yeah.
Just like, what? The first time you see it, it's funny as hell.
Oh, it's a good movie. It's still a classic, man.
Yeah. The White Russian that he's consistently licking off his mustache throughout
the movie. He's always drinking a White Russian, even in the bowling alley when he's talking to the stranger. He's drinking a White Russian.
The dude abides. Yeah, we'd have these people that bomb out these Big Lebowski quotes, like in the middle of the afternoon. And
but didn't Jeff Bridges play in that one old movie about the Starman or Star some Star?
I don't know. Between the two of us, you are much more steeped in movies than I am. I can remember
parts of it.
What is your?
But I can't remember.
Give me your top three movies.
See, I knew you were going to say something like that. I can't. I have to think about it.
Give me one.
Mac, remember,
Give me one good movie.
I have a brain injury, man. I can't think of.
Stop it.
My thoughts like that don't work.
I'm not Tina. Okay, stop it.
No, sir. I'm being serious. I can't.
You can't think like that?
I can't do what you just asked me to do. Like, I can't do that anymore.
You can't?
No, dude. That's bothered me it's getting worse.
You know what I was, Mike, you know what I was noticing? Speaking of that, I played a speech I found that Admiral Stockdale, he was interviewed. And it's amazing, I mean, him sitting there talking about his experience at the Hanoi Hilton when he disfigures himself, you know, that they were going to take him downtown to these groups of intellectuals that met, and they were going to parade him in front of them and try to engage him to say something against the United States. And they said, "We're going downtown." And he knew what that meant. So he takes a straight razor and he starts scraping like a reverse mohawk. So he's cutting the hair off of his head, straight down the middle of his head. The guard comes back and sees it. There's blood everywhere. The guard's like, ah, how can you do this? How can you do this? And Stockdale said, I got in the position that they tortured me in, which was in these ropes that were there. And he said, so I started to move towards the ropes, and the guy yells at him, you don't deserve the ropes! He said, I knew he was in trouble. And so they lock him back in the cage, and he hears one of them say, go get a hat, we'll take him down there. And he looks around his cell, and he sees the waste bucket. He said, I'm not going to use that, I'll get infected, but I'm going to disfigure my face so they can't use me. And so he grabs the stool, the wooden stool that's in there, and he starts bashing himself in the face. And you hear him talking about it. And you're watching it going, holy shit. And it's amazing. The other thing that's really interesting is he talks about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. He leads the flights that attack these quote-unquote patrol boats during the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But he says, except there's one important thing. They weren't there. There was no patrol boats there. He said, so I led the first bombing raid into North Vietnam on completely false pretenses, you know, but that was my job. And you see him talking about it. It's awesome. But my point in all of this is as he's talking, you can see him searching. You can see him searching for what he wants to say. And at the time, I want to say he's probably about 70 years old. And you know, so he's older, right? But he's not elderly, I would say. Getting there, certainly, but you can see him searching for words. And I watching it, I thought, you know, that got to be from, you know, from the physical trauma that his head suffered throughout possibly his ejection.
Yeah, I can't. That's why, you know, when you always say, like, would you do this again? And I'm like, and it never comes to me, like, you ask me right away, and I can't recall. But then if I sit and think about it, I'm like yesterday, when you said, hey, I was, you know, seriously. So I think about, okay, what did I do yesterday? But the problem comes into is I'll start thinking about it, and I'll start, let's say you ask me, and I start telling you. And then about halfway into it, I'm like, oh, shit, no, that was Tuesday. Or that was a piece of Monday, piece of Tuesday, and a piece of Wednesday. And it never comes out. And, you know, so, yeah, the wife or people start to notice it because they'll go, oh, no, Mike, that was, you know, Tuesday. And then sometimes I'm like, because in my mind I'm like, no, that was yesterday. And they're like, no, dude, believe me, that was Tuesday. And then I catch myself and I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. Last session, remember the last 3 months, not this one, but cause this one, the headaches are actually doing better, but the last 3 month period,
yeah,
I was really screwed up. I mean, they were really hurting, but my memory was shot.
Somebody mentioned that to me within the last week.
What, that Gunner's memory shot?
No, but when we were in North Carolina, like you were sleeping in late, right? And
yeah, I can't. Yeah.
And the windows and the curtains were drawn. And
yeah, I can't do bright light. Yeah.
And I think it was Rudy said, man, I didn't realize the Gunner, you know, he dealt with that. And I said, yeah, I mean, neither did I. I've heard him talk about it, but, you know, living in the same room, a little bit different experience.
And so, you know, people ask me, how'd you cope with it in Afghanistan? I was on pills. I mean, I was taking Vicodin every day in Afghanistan with Flextrol and psychosomatic drugs, you know, anti-seizure medication, all that stuff. You know, and like I said, if you could go to jail for, you know, lying about your medical health, you know, I the doctor convinced me that I was medically cleared to go. Because when I came back from because I left Quantico and I was put on whatever the duty was. Basically, I was not worldwide deployable, which killed me.
You were non-worldwide deployable?
I was categorized as non, I was taken off the worldwide deployable list, you know, whatever that is.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I was on non, I was, I basically I was non-deployable because of medical issues. And so I skipped out of town in Quantico, convinced the doctors in, Camp Pendleton, because I knew them. These were my buddies.
Right.
You know, and I said, hey man, I need a favor. Come on, Garner. No, seriously. I need you to do a physical on me and tell me I'm good to go to Afghanistan with the regiment. And they're like, can't do that. I called them out on it, played the, you know, it's like we all do.
Right.
You know, I'm not telling you that maybe if you get technical, right, you violate some little oath, but I'm not telling you that no one's getting hurt. There's no victim in this crime.
Right.
So I deployed. You know, I got on the list. I deployed. But then when I got back from that one, dude, I was really hurt. Oh. And then I went to I volunteered myself to get off narcotics prescription. I mean, I never took it legal. But I got off of that. And then that's when the headache started and everything else. And I think what got me through it was, I mean, shit, we were running two division exercises a year, plus all the other jobs I had on my desk about being, you know, division gunner. So I was always constantly busy. I was always in it. I couldn't think about anything else. I was still traveling. And then I retire, and then it all comes to a crashing halt, which I needed. I'm not complaining.
No.
It all comes to a crashing halt. And then I slow down, and I see life. You know, it's like, oh, I got all this time. But now you're dealing with, everything catches up. Now it's payback. All right. How much longer do I got to pay back? You know, the rest of your life? Ugh. That's what I talk about. You know, that's why people, I get upset when we sit and talk about suicide. And again, I'm not saying that I'm not living. There's other people that have it worse than me by far. But it's not a, you know, that kind of situation never leads to, give me a ranking from 1 to 10, how bad you think. You know, that's not what we're talking about.
But it doesn't.
You know, I thought that was the stupidest question ever asked by a doctor. Give me a ranking from 1 to 10, how bad the pain is. And like I said, the best answer I ever gave was to a female doctor, unknown. I didn't know her. It was in the Mission Viejo Trauma Center right there off of.
Right.
Yeah, I can't remember the Oso Parkway. Yeah, off of Oso, off the 405. And I went there. They were giving me Demerol because my head hurt so bad. And we lived closer there. And if you go to base, back then, base, the hospital at the lake was further because they were done building the new hospital. Yet. So I had to go to the Mission Viejo, went up there, got the Demerol. And the lady says to me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is your pain? And that's when I told her. I looked at her and said, if I could stand up and get to my gun, I'd shoot myself. And she looked at me, and she walked out of the room. And then they came in with another shot of Demerol, which knocked me out, and it took away the pain. You know, so I'm like, what do you mean, pain? Oh, it's, you know, if you say 10, they think, well, this guy's lying. No one ever experiences 10. You know, what is pain? You know, and that's why I tell doctors when I go in now, because I have, for the last, you know, shit, 10 years? No, 14 years, 2004. 14 years, my pain tolerance is off the charts. Because, you know, they'll go in and they'll do, like, they'll give me a shot. And they'll say, okay, that should do you right there. That's fine. I said, okay, we'll see. Hour later, they come back in. Are you still experiencing pain? Yes. Where? Right here. You know, well, we gave you twice the dose of, and I said, whatever. You know, just take the pain away. They give me another shot. Come back. Now, no one has ever, you know, I said, it's not a competition, guys. Give me a dosage that puts me, like, put me to sleep. Like, make me go, and you know, count back to 90 or 100, you get to 99. I want that kind of relief. That's the relief that you're looking for. So I had my MRI today.
Today?
Yeah, at 1. So this one's going to be a long one, man. Oh, shit, I'm going to be in there for hours. Because they're going to do the normal MRI. You go in, you do your thing, blah, 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 mostly focused on the brain. And then I get out. Then I got to take, then they get me with an IV and they inject me with all that radioactive dye.
Right.
And then I go back in the MRI for the radioactive dye. And I think they give me, it looks like you're set up for, have you ever had, it, so it looks like, dude, scary, because it looks like lethal injection time. They give you an IV. No, I'm serious. They give you an
IV. How do you know what a lethal injection is, though?
Because I've seen it.
Oh,
like,
on TV.
Not in person, but, yeah. You know, the things of the vials they got on a machine, and then the plungers automatically push them down one at a time, you know?
Oh. You know, I've seen pictures of it. I've never actually seen a video or anything like that of it, but yeah.
What they do on mine is they put up the same, like, 2-3 big, these big freaking vials, you know? Then they put the IV in my arm, and I'm sitting in this thing, and as I'm getting in the machine, or I'm in the MRI, they're like, okay, here comes solution one. You know, they're telling you on the speaker, you're going to feel the metallic taste in your on your palate, and you do. And you're going to have a strong urge to pee, so don't pee, please. And you're like, oh. So you start tasting metal on your tongue. Like, well, ah. But you're watching these plungers push down, so I always tell myself, or I always tell the doc when I go in there, lethal injection time. Do I get my last words? And they laugh about it. Like, you're the only person that comes in here that calls us the lethal injection machine. I said, because it does. It looks just like one, man. I mean, it's not like I've you know, faced death row, but from the movies I've seen, shit, other than being strapped down and having an audience, looks like the same damn thing. So I go through that, and then when you come out, you're peeing like neon green, and they're telling you like, oh, there's no radioactive isotopes in your body. It's actually completely harmless. They're like, yeah. How come my pee is etching the porcelain off the toilet bowl? Right. This is not good, boys and girls. I turn the light out. You don't flush the toilet, you turn the light out. And there's a green, ominous glow from the toilet bowl.
From my toilet bowl. Lighting up the room.
Yeah. Looks like a Martian's coming out of the water.
Nope.
But I got that to look forward to today. But, you know, I was telling Buck the other day, and I said, worst case scenario is, they come back and say, oh, sir, you know, I always, whenever they come back in with the results, the one thing is, if you go home and they say, we'll call you, if you get a phone call within an hour of getting home, sit down. This is going to be a rough one. If you don't get a phone call for the next 3 days, whew. But yeah, if you get the phone call within the hour after you take in the test and they say it's going to be a couple days, make sure you're sitting down.
Yeah.
And the next thing you probably want to do is call the family.
Yeah.
Because
that's
new thing can be good.
That's not a good phone call. That's not a good phone call.
And like I said, my biggest fear has always been when I go in there, what I don't want to hear is, because, you know, one doctor put it, when I hate when doctors put shit in your head and you think about stuff. And so the doctors, one doctor I had was like, you know, you have every symptom of brain cancer, but you don't have brain cancer. I'm like, oh, shit, doc. Where did you learn your bedside manner? Jack the Ripper? I mean, what kind of doctor, you know, he's looking at me like, I said, you don't tell people that.
What is
you
wrong?
Know?
What's wrong with, let me mute. You have
every symptom of brain cancer, but the lucky thing is you don't have it.
Let me think out loud in front of this son of a bitch.
Yeah. Hey, Jack the Ripper here. I'm your bedside doctor. What can I do for you? So I always think about that in my head now. I'm like, oh, what if they missed it? What if, you know, what if this comes out? And then you start thinking, okay, what is on my bucket list? What am I going to do? Who am I going to go take out?
Who is on my bucket
list?
Who's on
I have
my
bucket
list?
And then I have a list of seeking revenge and retribution list.
Oh, I thought it was like going to go into the bucket list.
No. Bucket list is all fun. And I guess, depending on the situation, that would be fun too.
Do you have a bucket list?
Yeah. Actually, I do. I've always wanted to climb Everest.
No kidding.
I don't know why. Yeah, it's so appealing to me. I want to climb Everest. And then if I had, that would be the last thing I would do. And if I had terminal cancer, yeah. If I got to the top, I'd just jump up. See you later, motherfuckers! Just go, you know, double birds, backflip. Woo-hoo.
Out. Muscleman, out.
Yeah, but what a way, man. Did you see that son of a bitch? Let's make a movie about that.
You'd be
like Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, you'd be writing letters because that's a relatively long fall, man.
You think? But no, or riding a nuclear bomb out of a B-52.
There you go.
That would be a way to go too, boys.
You
with a cowboy hat, with your boots and spurs on.
You and Slim Pickens. You and Slim Pickens. Here's an email. Battle of the Hurtgood Forest began 74 years ago today. Hi, Mac. Yep. You and Mike Musclehead were discussing this earlier in the week and really got me interested in it. Strange how the battles we win get all the attention, even decades later. Really curious how Wikipedia has U.S. casualties and losses somewhere between 33,000 and 55,000. That's quite a large range of error for modern-day statistics. You also mentioned some things about the Marshall Plan that I wasn't aware of. You keep me listening when I learn stuff. Fine work. Thank you very much.
So, yeah, I know. And I was reading that. That's why the Hurricane Forest came up the other day when we were talking, because it started about this time. You know, it was a fall offensive. September 19th was the actual date. And that would be yesterday. So, and it ended almost, 3 months later? December? Yeah, December.
Wow.
September, October, November, December. Yeah, so, jeez.
Yeah. If you look at, you know, like, for instance, I didn't even know till I looked it up, where is the Hurtgen Forest? So, if you go into Belgium, right, so you land in France, you come through France, and you hook into what is central Belgium, right? And there's some cities that, you know, we would recognize. Liege. There's a massacre at Malmedy, a famous one that involves.
That's in Belgium. That's in Belgium.
Yeah, Sepp Dietrich and those guys. So it's the Hurtgen Forest is on the road between Liege, Aachen is in Germany, and then it's in this valley that has Dusseldorf and Cologne, so major German cities in the southwest, and Bonn is another major German city that's in the southwest part of Germany, on the road headed east towards northeast to Berlin. So is that the Ruhr Valley?
The Ruhr Valley? R-U-H-R?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's the Ruhr Valley or not, but the Hurtgen Forest is west of that. And when you see that number, 55,000, holy smokes, you know? It's just jaw-dropping. It's just jaw-dropping, so...
Yeah, and I wish I would have known more about it, because I was in that area.
Oh. You know?
And I would have loved to walk the battlefield,
right.
You know, because I really like that stuff. And I never saw it. I mean, the closest I got to Hurricane, and then in that case, you know, looking at it, was I was in Cologne, you know, just north of Bonn.
Yeah, that's on the road, man. You were.
Yeah, I drove from Bonn, Cologne, up to Dortmund, and then we went to Munster.
Yeah.
We flew out of Munster.
Yeah, The and you look at that, and you think that they spent 3 months in that region, with, you know, obviously the Germans defending Germany and the first belt of major German cities inside their country, you know, Dusseldorf, Cologne, and Bonn. And again, if you ever see pictures of it,
look at the pictures of the battlefield at Hurricane. Yeah, it's, and you know what really upsets me is when we look at that as a failure. I look at it as a model, a testament to the bravery and the courage of those young men that was fighting on that battle.
Right.
I mean, they were outnumbered, they were outgunned, they were outclassed. I mean, they were up against some of the best the Germans had. And they were supposed to be in a quiet sector.
And the kind of terrain.
Water, yeah.
And Omar Bradley is the commander of the Allied forces there, and a German general by the name of Walter Model.
He was good.
And these guys have fought in Africa. These guys have fought in Russia. I mean, these guys are no strangers to major battles, and the United States is just cutting its teeth on major battles, you know. And then you give them the terrain advantage of a forest and operating inside Germany where they're completely familiar with it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's tough. You know, now we would say draw a circle around it, draw a red X. That's not penetrable, and let's turn it. Let's move someplace else. But, you know, we're a different army today than we were then. But, yeah, so, you know, German casualties estimated at 28,000.
How much?
28,000. The Hurricane Forest cost the U.S. First Army at least 33,000 killed, according to Wikipedia, and 33,000 killed and wounded, including both combat and non-combat losses, with upper estimates at 55,000. So, I agree with the email. That's a pretty large interval, you know, almost doubling it at the upper end. How do you not know? Seems like. Do we not do that kind of accounting when it's not in our favor? So
yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty amazing.
A lot of those guys played. The one that you probably see in the movies that talks about, or kind of doesn't talk about Hurricane, but it does a little bit on this whole thing. It's the 119th Panzer Division, or 116th Panzer Division. They're the ones who mauled the 28th, known as the Bloody Bucket. The division, the 28th attacked into the Hurricane during a little battle, and they ran right smack dab into the 116th Panzer, which these guys were, they had their shit wired, man, and they turned them into, they, like a meat grinder. Oh. And there was like a Pennsylvania National Guard unit or something like that that was activated, that was up there, maybe that was 28, but one of them just, I mean, decimated. And if you look, I have a huge, like, phone book thing of World War II encyclopedia, and it has all the facts.
Wow.
Like, when the unit was started, how big it was, when it was destroyed, or what if it was converted. And you look at the First Army was rendered basically inoperable after the Hurricane Force. And they were, you think about it, 20, 50... That's the Marine Corps Division plus the 2nd Marine Division gone.
And we're talking about division and all its supporting assets.
Everything.
Everything gone, erased.
Yeah.
And if you get towards the upper limit, right, then you're talking about all 3 Marine divisions. If you go to 55,
yeah, 60,000. Yeah. You're talking about all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
gone.
Yeah, gone. I just saw a monument, and I don't know that I've ever seen anything like this. It's in the Hurtgen Forest, and I saw the name on it, dedicated to Lieutenant Friedrich Langfield. Listen to this. No man hath greater love than he who laid down his life for his enemy. In memory of Lieutenant Friedrich Langfield, 2nd Company, Fusilier Battalion, 275th Infantry Division, here in the Hürtgen Forest on November 12th, 1944, Lieutenant Langfield, a German officer, gave his life while trying to save the life of an American soldier lying severely wounded in the Wild Sow minefield and appealing for medical aid. Placed at this site on October 7, 1994, 50 years after the battle, the 22nd United States Infantry Society, World War II. And then under that it says, deeds, not words, and then a cross. And then there's the same inscription done in German.
German, yeah, below.
I've never seen a tribute to an opposing member of the military put up by an opposing force. That's amazing. Absolutely.
Yeah, but look at, when did it go up? 1994,
50 years after the battle.
So someone had to do the research.
But you know, I mean, those, I'm sure that story.
We had more of that.
Yeah, I'm sure that story is legendary among those guys who watched it. I mean, do you remember the story about Americans and Germans singing Silent Night on Christmas? I want to say it's a World War I story. You know, and did that really happen or was that bullshit? And I remember reading something that said that, no, it actually happened. And so there are these stories, and when they happen, they kind of have their own life to them. They spread like wildfire. Hey, did you hear about? And, yeah, but this one, again, it's interesting. We don't, as Mike said, you know, as the email said, we tend not to talk about the ones that didn't go as well. Well, you know, that we don't find some kind of heroic theme in it. And the Hürtgen Forest is kind of like the meat grinder on Iwo Jima. There's not a whole lot glorious about it, and there wasn't anything, you know, there wasn't any grand penetration, turning movement, or anything. It was just this unbelievably brutal and deadly yard-by-yard fight that was waged in a very small place on Iwo Jima, and you don't tend to read that much about it. The Hürtgen Forest is that. It's this horrific place in a forest where two armies get it on and neither one gives for 90 days, which is amazing. Amazing.
But the, and like I said, there's some good to take away from this. And I think that's lost when we reject that kind of past. We don't talk about it. It's not in the history books like Normandy, Calais, and all these other winning battles where we took the objective and we did well, Bastogne, when we held out, you know. It's like, but you know what? The bravery and the death were just as real.
Right.
And, you know, and the duties and what those guys did, you know, is amazing. You know, most people you'd see run in the face battle. These guys, they slugged it out.
Yeah, and again, it's not like they were like, I've got to survive two more months and then, you know, we're redeploying. That wasn't their war. I'm here till this is over.
Yeah.
I'm here till
there's two ways it's going to be over. Yeah. Over for me or over entirely for the war.
You know, I played that, I played audio about an hour ago, that Lieutenant Spears audio. And I was talking about, you know, in kind of building the post-traumatic winning, trying to find things to use in that class. My problem is All Marine Radio has so much of that stuff because we talk about it. It's amazing. From and everything from the Commandant to PFC Cal Marvin from Iwo Jima to Jeremiah Workman to Elizabeth Smart to my sister Peggy to Lieutenant Spears. There's so much incredible stuff, and Spears' comments are, how do you function in this thing that will paralyze you? And you know, and he tells Blythe, until you realize that you're already dead, you won't be able to function. And it's, you listen to it, And that is so worthy of discussion today.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, with warriors. Like, what does this mean? In what context could this possibly make sense? And then you have that discussion. It's just awesome stuff, you know, in terms
life
of...
Life gets better when you realize, in those situations, that you're already dead. You're just on borrowed time. You know, the expiration has already gone up. You're just running on borrowed time. So I'm fumes, baby. So if you get to live another day, God bless. Accept the fact. Yeah, accept it already. And just, you know, be at peace with it.
Yeah, that it's out of your hands. You're no longer in control.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when Chief Officer Black and I, Black was an EOD guy, and we were doing the 11 block clear in Fallujah. And that, you remember that when we were pinned down and the F-18s came out of nowhere and smoked these dudes in a courtyard. But I was thinking, right then and right there, you know, there was no fear that grips your body. You know, I looked over at Black. He looked at me. We kind of laughed about this and said, and he, I think he said first, he said, shit, if all people are going to die with it's you. And I said, yeah. He was a gunny then. Now he's a chief officer. He put in his package, got EOD, the chief officer EOD. One of the bravest guys I know. But funny as hell too. But, you know, those guys, we were pinned down machine gun fire, and it was just coming all over. And it was like, you know, matter of time before they start figuring out, they're watching the bullets impact and they're on the ground. And you don't want to give up and give them a target. So you just try and get as low as you possibly could. And then out of blue, man, wings, those angels come out ripping out of the sky with 20 millimeter. And then I think they dropped the bomb, right? The second Dash 2 did. But it was just that amazing feeling like, oh, thank you, God. Thank you. But then again, you know, the randomness of it is, you know, Luke Scott was shot in the head shortly after that. You know, after it all. I mean, just the randomness just could drive you crazy. So when people are always like, oh, you know, I don't know, I don't know when my time is. One thing you learn in the military when you're in combat is, if you're in combat and you don't walk out believing that there's a God, then you weren't in combat. Because you understand when it's your time, it's your time. And there's nothing you can do about it. Because you can be right next and walk away with not a scratch on you, and the guy within arm's distance just be blown to bits. And it's, I mean, just like, and people get into that situation like, oh, the survivor's guilt. Like, how did I make it through that? Be lucky.
Lucky.
You made it through. Yeah, good luck. You know, like I said, you're already dead, man. We're already all dead. You guys good with that? Yeah, we're good with that. Okay, let's go.
I don't know that I would say it like that, though. I would say, like, I would say it's out of your hands whether you live or die. You know, so don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
I say that too, but I also said a lot of times where I was like, hey, man, you're already dead.
But you know what? When he said that, I mean, it's a different shade of what he's saying. When he said that, right, you're like, holy shit, I can't believe somebody said that on TV. Because it's not like you, like, roll around and advertise that. You know, it's something that you would say. It's something that you would say to, you know, but, and that's one of the things why Band of Brothers is so good, is there is so much content in there. You know, if you've gone near a combat zone, you'll recognize it. And it's incredibly well done. It's incredibly well done. That's what, to me, you know, Mike, it's almost, I was thinking about this morning. I woke up at about 4 and I didn't go back to sleep. And how in God's name have we fought And never really addressed the mental health part of it, you know? We've done this for, I mean, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and it's been a part of every one of them, call it battle fatigue, but we've never really talked about it. And I remember interviewing Tom Drowdy, and he talked about going to Vietnam for the first time. I said, hey, so when you went, did the guys who had fought in Korea, did they tell you anything? He said, nope, nobody said a word. And then I remember talking and interviewing a guy who was in 1st Tank Battalion. They got the T-48 tank on the pier in San Diego. they trained in it in boats on the way over there. They drove it around the Japanese stadium for a day. They offloaded it, drove around, drove it back onto the ships, and then they sailed for Incheon after they all went out and got drunk. And I said, did those guys talk to you about, you know? And he said, no, nobody said a word. It's kind of weird almost that we don't talk about it. You know, you would think that guys would sit down and say, hey, boys, let me just tell you, you know, what you're going to see and what you're going to feel, and don't worry about it. Just put it out of your head, man. Just do your thing. So for whatever reason.
Just one more thing it's one more thing to worry about that you have no control of. Absolutely not. And so that violates my principle of, I don't get upset. If I can't affect the outcome, I just let it go. You know, I have that discussion all the time with the people in my office. Why does that bother you? It just bothers me. What can you do about it? Nothing. You just want, okay, so you just want to be bothered. Just leave me alone. But, you know, it drives me crazy because it's like, why do you let this get to you? Do you have control over it? If you answer yes, then okay, fix it. Then change it to the outcome you want. I can't. Then you're weak. I'm not weak. Don't call me weak. Okay. You know what? What? So if you can't, and so the answer is no, you can't affect the outcome. Okay. So why are we dealing with this then? Right. The traffic on I-5 drives me crazy. Okay? Can you do anything about it? The only thing you can do is don't get on it.
Yes.
Avoid it.
Yeah, or get an audiobook.
And if everybody did that, it wouldn't be so bad now, would it? But no. I mean, but you're not willing to do
right.
that.
Right.
Or you're bitching about something like, well, what can you do? Can you invent teleporters? Can we just walk into a phone booth in our house and say, take me to Lowe's? You know, there you are. No. Okay then, deal with it. What can you complain about things you have control over? Like, man, this sushi sucks. Don't eat it. Get up and leave. You have control.
Somebody asked me, I don't know, it was in the last 48 hours. Oh, Colleen did. She sent me a text yesterday or the day before. What are two things you hate? I said, hate? She said, yes. What are two things you hate? I said, I hate dog shit. She said, Dad, I said, write it down.
I hate it.
Since I was a kid, I've hated it in Sacramento. I've stepped in it. I used to mow over it when it's 110 in Sacramento. That smell would explode. I hate it. And then she said, well, what's the other thing? I said, I'd have to think about that. She said, Dad, I need two things. I said, I hate complainers.
Yeah, that's it. That's my number one. I hate people who complain. I hate them.
Right.
I hate them.
God bless you. I wish I lived in the world that you live in, where you had, you know, you could bitch about stuff, and that's what you can do in your day. God bless you.
Yeah.
God bless you, because I don't live in that world. I've always been responsible for either changing it or caring about people that are dealing with it. But God bless you for just being able to bitch and bitch and bitch and bitch and bitch and bitch. Now, get away from me.
Get away.
Right now. Move away from the light.
Bitchers, man. That's all. The world doesn't need more people with this, you know, we need more problem solvers, not problem admirers.
Right? No, without doubt. You know, Mike and I have talked about finding adults in the room when you're, okay, not him, not him, not him, not her. Who's that person? I need to go meet them and introduce myself, because that was the only adult in this room. And if I need help, that's who I need to go to. And that's how you put your own little network together of problem solvers. And it's amazing, you know, even in your time in the Marine Corps, people that will show up at meetings and they're bitching about stuff. You're like, good God, man. Like, who is that? So, anyway, interesting. We need to do a little bit of a deep dive on the Hurtgen Forest.
I got a book on it, actually. I should read it.
Here's an email. I've got interested now, like a few people, I'm sure, that have been listening to you. What was the bloodiest battle of World War II for the U.S. military?
Oh, of the U.S.?
Was it Normandy? Okinawa?
For the U.S. or the bloodiest battle? Because I would say...
For the U.S.
Yeah. For the U.S., man, it wouldn't be... I know Stalingrad was the worst by far. Over a million people lost lives in Stalingrad. Let's see, the Battle of, where was it, Italy? Anzio? Was Anzio?
Yeah, Anzio is American. Here's the table. List the battles with most United States military fatalities. The Meuse-Argonne Offensive, which is, World War II.
No. So,
Battle of the
Battle of Stalingrad, which we weren't part of. The Battle of Berlin. That was the Red Army as well. Okay, number three, the Battle of Moscow. That's Red Army. And okay. The Battle of Narva. That's another one that people don't know a lot about. And that's actually a really neat story or a neat battle to talk about. The Battle of Narva.
Well, listen to this, Mike. These are these footnotes. All right, so I'm looking at this list, World War II, right? World War II, this is number five. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The Battle of the Hurtgen Forest is number 6. And they say over 12,000 killed. What? So then there's a footnote. The footnote says 50,410 Americans died in the Rhineland from September of 1944 until March of 1945. So I guess it depends on your time frame for the Battle of the Hurtgen Forest. So they say 12,000. The Battle of Okinawa, over 14,000 killed. The Battle of Central Europe, which was, if you do it by time frame, March 22nd to May 8th of 1945, so the year following Normandy, the spring following Normandy, 15,000 killed in Central Europe. And we're talking only Americans. Normandy, 16,293 killed, and that's in a period from June 6th to July 24th. And then the Northern France campaign, which ensues directly after Normandy, has 70,844 killed. But by these numbers, the costliest battle of World War II is the Battle of the Bulge, December 16th of 44. So it follows the Hurtgen Forest and on the heels of the Hurtgen Forest until January but again, it's only a matter of 40 days, the Battle of the Bulge, and 19,276 killed. And again, if you talk about the Hurtgen Forest, it's about 3 months. The Battle of the Bulge is up there in terms of similar number, but in 40 days, which is pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking. I got this whole battle. So it lists like, you know, I have a book on this. I'll read this up, and we can talk about this.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting. What would be interesting, Mike, is kind of to pull the string on. What are the battles that were most costly that we're least familiar with? And why is that?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, like the police pocket.
Right.
You know, Burma. Shit. More people died from in Burma in those campaigns for malaria than they did by enemy.
Right. Right.
You know, you got the Battle of Lausanne. You got the battle. I mean, we only know stuff that took place during that. But, you know, then you look at, dude, you want to look at, like, deaths? Oh, when Mao Zedong was coming to power in the, what, 48 after World War II? And you had the Liu Shen campaign and the Hulahi campaign and the Pingjin campaign. Close to a million people died.
Right.
Each one of those. Like, oh, God. But, yeah, this goes all the way up to the invasion of Iraq, so it's not really listed all the way up. So 2003, they list 34,543. But what's this footnote? Must be included Iraqi casualties.
No, but one of the things that's, and I said this before, but you, as an American kid, you grew up studying American history. And, you know, your view of World War II is, well, it started at Pearl Harbor, and then we did some stuff in the Pacific, then it went to Africa, then we invaded Normandy, then we defeated the Germans. And then you read about the Eastern Front, you read about China, Burma, and you're like, wait a minute. So in Europe, we kind of piled on towards the end. Russia and Germany were having the mother of all slugfest on the Eastern Front. I mean, they were literally 100% mobilized, 100% engaged in trying to annihilate each other. You know, the 6th Army was 600,000 Germans. Got encircled at Stalingrad. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit.
They had armies to surrender or decimate on the battlefield.
Can you imagine?
I'm not talking like, yeah, an army is three corps. And a corps is 3 to 4 divisions. So 12 divisions, you know.
And all that, and everything that goes with it.
And everything that goes with it.
Everything
that
goes with it. And so, you know, I've read pieces of, you know, kind of the whispered discussions that went on in Germany when that, the news of, you know, General von Paulus and his army you know, they didn't say they surrendered, but had been surrounded in Stalingrad. And it's like, what? Like, what do you, that can't be. The 6th Army's been on the triumphant march, right? Blasting its way through, you know, southern Russia and, you know, headed for Stalingrad. And Stalingrad was ready to fall. And now they've been annihilated. They've been destroyed. Like, it's like unfathomable, right? I'm sure it's like the Americans felt when, like, all of our battleships at Pearl Harbor were, like, sunk. Like, what? Like, what? It's like something you can't even believe. So, yeah. And so, yeah, so it's a bit of a shock and to your perspective on history once the lens gets broadened a little bit and you see estimates from, you know, the Russians that they lost 20 million people in World War II. And
yeah, those are the counting of just the deaths that they incurred on the battlefield, not the ones that frickin' they killed.
Right. So, and you're looking at that going, and we piled on in 1944 and went from France to Germany? Okay, maybe we didn't have the role that I thought we had in that war.
If you ever want to read or a battlefield study on a battlefield that was pretty remarkable that I don't think much of anything was ever written, is read the one about Narva. That was in eastern Estonia, right there on the Isthmus. That there's a huge lake, and I don't know if it was this one, but it was frozen. It was wintertime. And, you know, they were using the lake to come across, and it was just the battle that took place between the Germans and the Soviets in there were, oh, you know, because it was such a small area. And, oh, my goodness.
I was exposed to that. I remember, when I was a lieutenant, I don't know if you ever met him, Mike, but you were around 5th Marines at the same time, or not long after I got there, but he was the regimental XO. He was Lieutenant Colonel, Vietnam guy by the name of Marvin Hopgood. And I think he went on to become a Brigadier General. But anyway, he gave the first reading class I ever went to in the Marine Corps. Like, hey, we got to go to a regimental PME. On what? Like, on reading. What? Yeah, he's going to talk about professional reading. Okay, and I was a reader, right? And I went there, and I'd never heard of the books he was talking about. And one of the books that he talked about was, he said the best book he's ever read on war is was The Forgotten Soldier. And it's about a German infantryman who goes to, he's a train guard, and then he gets offered like a month of leave if he joins the infantry. So he joins the infantry, and he joins the Grossdeutschland division, and he gets sent to Russia, and he gets his ass kicked, right, all the way out of Russia, winds up being captured by the Brits up by Denmark or something as they've retreated. And the story's just unbelievable. The story about, you know, being on a train and seeing another train going by you and looking and say, like, is that lumber in those cars? It's all frozen and sticking up. And then you realize as you get close that those are human bodies that are frozen that they threw in an open rail car, and they're taking to the rear. And just like, yeah. Holy shit. And the scope of it, you know, and the battles of it, you know, there's one description in it that I've never forgotten. And it's of these tankers, right? So as the Russians were shit kicking the Germans out of their country. But again, just think of gigantic formations, tens and then hundreds of thousands of guys on each side. The Russians are encircling the Germans. And the Germans would have to find a weakness, and then they would have to attack it, and they would have to open the shoulders of the penetration, and so that everybody could get out of it, and they would have to hold the shoulders so everybody could get out, or you were going to get annihilated. And so they were marching one way, leaving one of these pockets, and this tank company was parked there, and the tank company was going to launch a counterattack. And he said, you know, we were marching past these guys, and they were sitting there with their black, you know, their black piss cutters on, smoking cigarettes, talking and laughing. He said, but they knew that they were going to die within the next 12 hours. They knew it. And they were just sitting there talking and laughing and, you know, doing what soldiers do. We were marching by, you know, we were humping our asses off, you know, through the Russian dirt. You know, and yelling good luck at them and take it to them and all that kind of stuff. And they were just smoking and laughing and nodding their heads and saying thanks. You know, we're going to go get them. He said, but it's a sight I will never forget. Their confidence. They didn't look, they weren't afraid. They were simply being German soldiers. And
I got a bolt though, man. I got to get to the MRI.
All right. Well, good luck on your MRI. Are you going to live stream it?
Yeah. It can't be that. I can't have any metal on my body.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, good luck.
All right. I'll let you know after.
All right, bud. See ya.
Bye.
The Forgotten Soldier. The writer is Guy Sajer, Sajer. Now, some of the people have taken the book to task and said, well, some of it might not be actual autobiographical in nature. It might be, some of it is probably composite characters, not all of it his experience, because if he was with this unit, it went here and here, and they kind of take it to, task. I don't think it in any way, shape, or form invalidates the narrative that he writes about. To include when he came home. He's walking down the road to his home, and it's this experience that he never thought he would have. After, I want to say, 3 years of fighting in Russia, and then going to a prisoner of war camp, he walks up to his house, and he walks into the yard, and as he's walking towards his front door, I think his mother opens the door, and she sees him, and she wonders, like, who this stranger is. And she looks, and, you know, and he was born in the Alsace-Lorraine region. His mother is German, his father's French. And so he thought the German army looked better, so he joined the German army, and his mother wanted him to join the German army. And so he looks at his mother, and he speaks to her in German, and he says, you know, Mama. And with that, she looks and she kind of squints, and then her eyes get big, and then she faints. But, it's an incredible story. Marvin Hopgood, though, Lieutenant General, who was a Lieutenant Colonel of the XO of the 5th Marine Regiment, the first reading class I ever went to. Interesting stuff. That'll do it. On a Thursday. Here's a couple of emails. Taking Hill 400 Army Rangers versus the Fallschirmer Jäger. Rangers, man. I'm a fan of the Rangers. I worked with them a little bit in Iraq. Pretty professional organization. Herndon Forest. It was one of the bloodiest battles of World War II. It ruined general and junior officers' careers. It ruined divisions. The Bloody Bucket Division of the 28th Division. Here's a book called The Bloody Forest. The Battle for Herndon, September 1944 to January 1945. Mac, I read this book on my Nook three years ago about the Herndon Forest. Outstanding. Some backup on that. Here's another email from earlier today. Mac, I listened to Elizabeth Smart. I don't know that I've ever heard that. I've heard you talk about the movie, but I hadn't watched it. How incredible. As you said, she has every reason to be a dysfunctional human being, but her words of hope and her words of encouragement are amazing. Could you play it one more time before you get off the air? I could do that. Here's Elizabeth Smart. You'll hear Steve Winwood on the backside of it. But here's Elizabeth Smart. And these are audio cuts from parts that she does in the movie she produced about her experience being kidnapped and raped and held for, 9.5 months or something like that. So Elizabeth Smart, in her own words.
I want people to walk away with a sense of hope, because at the end of the day, bad things happen. We don't deserve them to happen. But that doesn't mean that our life is over. That doesn't mean that we need to give up or that we can never be happy again. You can go through hell and you can still have a happy ending. And you can reclaim your life. You can decide who you are. I hope that people come out of it feeling like that gives them the courage, the strength to keep on fighting, to keep on going. Life is worth living. Why did I tell you this story? Those posters on the wall, the children like me, the others who have it worse, the ones who don't come home. I wanted to tell you, as someone who has been through hell, that there still is hope. Find the miracle, hold on to it, and keep going. I'm not cracked. I'm not shattered. I am Elizabeth Smart.
Elizabeth Smart. Yeah, I love that. I agree with you. Mike told me to watch it, and I did, and I was blown away by how inspired I was. And that quote is awesome. So now we'll get out of here after that. No, you know, I'll tell you what, if you can't tell, I mean, I love talking about this stuff, and this show has taken turns that I didn't think it would take. And they're all great turns, so good stuff. Good stuff. And finding stuff like that. I think for we as veterans, the opportunity to help civilians is, to me, one of my favorite things. The opportunity to help younger Marines and soldiers and combatants is worthy of your life's work to better prepare them so when they go into harm's way, they can say, they told me this was going to happen. I know what to do. Which will put them so much further down the road than I think that we were. So that feels great as well. So. Don't touch that dial. More of this great program coming up on a Thursday. All Marine Radio, over and out.